You're gonna be mine, like it or not. Made of my mind, right from the start. You might as well give up, start doing your part. You're gonna be mine, like it or not. Well, I told you before, you're gonna be my own. You gotta give up, I want to leave you alone. It's time that you knew, you're my only thought. You're gonna be mine, like it or not. Well, I know how it feels to sit and wait, but I won't give up at all. I'll keep trying to win your love. I know someday you'll fall. You know that you love me, believe it or not. It may take time, but I've got a lot. I want you to know, you're my only thought. You're gonna be mine, like it or not. I know how it feels to sit and wait, but I won't give up at all. I'll keep trying to win your love. I know someday you'll fall. You know that you love me, believe it or not. It may take time, but I've got a lot. I want you to know, you're my only thought. You're gonna be mine, like it or not. You're gonna be mine, like it or not.
One more from Garn Littledyke. I gotta find out more about this guy and who that band is and where they made the record. Really interesting sounds. Like it or not. Song that closes out his Wichita Lineman record. Daniel Menchie's behind us right now. We also heard more of this piece just before Garn. It's a brand new one called Vastus. You can go to Daniel's Bandcamp for more about that. Par Lindgren before that with some Gastro Duress. Electronically produced. Electronic Music, the name of the record. Rummet, the track we heard. We heard from Julius Hemphill doing The Painter for Oliver Lee Jackson from 1972's Dogon AD. Bono Burattini out of Italy. Ora Sono Un Lago, Lago, name of the CD. We heard Prove d'Esistenza Il Gesto. Chromosome from 1981 from their EP, self-titled Show of Terrorism was the name of the track. Scissor Fits before that. D.H. Lawrence Wasn't a Mexican from 1979. It Wasn't Nothing. And at the top of the set, Unit 3 plus Venus leading them with Beer. My name is Scott. Look forward to seeing you next week with my guest Bill Nace. Stay tuned for Mark. Tectonic is next. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM. Worldwide online at WFMU.org. Bye.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. I've got a great show for you today. We're going to be speaking with Cindy Cohen, who is currently the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, also known as the EFF. I say Cindy is currently the ED because, as you'll hear in the interview, she has announced that she's going to be stepping down soon, and we do talk about her replacement. The EFF, she says, is going to be in good hands. But the reason I wanted to bring Cindy onto the show is because she has a new memoir out called Privacy's Defender, talking about her career over 30 years, of the last 10 or so years of which is her time as executive director of the EFF. But we do talk about her career, as the title says, as Privacy's Defender, working against surveillance by the government and surveillance by big tech companies. And so it's really admirable work. It's important work. And we get her perspective on three major sets of cases that she was involved in or she led. And if you don't know the EFF, that's an organization worth looking into because it's well aligned with what I talk about on this show. You can find them at EFF.org. This is a nonprofit. It's been around for a long time, and we talk about the founding of the nonprofit in the interview. But it's fighting against the surveillance and other bad behavior of these government and corporate actors on behalf of us, the citizens, the users, the people who are affected by those decisions and those platforms. So they're really fighting on our behalf. They're doing great work. And so it's a pleasure to have Cindy on the show. If you want links to Cindy's book and the EFF and some other things, you can go to the episode page, which is at the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And then just click into the Cindy Cohen episode. Why don't we go ahead now and listen to my interview with Cindy Cohen, author of Privacy's Defender, here on Tectonic. Cindy Cohen, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you.
You've written a memoir called Privacy's Defender, My 30-Year Fight Against Digital Surveillance, published by MIT Press. This book describes three sets of lawsuits that you're involved in with the EFF, that is the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I should note up front that you are both a lawyer and the executive director of the EFF, and you've announced that you'll be stepping down in a few weeks. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
But before we get to the EFF and these three case studies, I thought we could start at the very, very beginning. The book is called Privacy's Defender. So, Cindy, why is it so important that we defend privacy?
I think of privacy perhaps a little differently than some people do. Some people think of privacy as like, you know, the Harry Potter cloak of invisibility that you stick over your head when you're about to do something, you know, sneaky. And of course, it can do that. But to me, privacy isn't important because of that. Privacy is important because it is a way that people with less power can have protection against people who have more power. And I see this in, you know, the small and the large. So in the small, my colleague Eva Galperin works with domestic violence victims whose perpetrators have been putting malware on their devices so that they can better control them. And these people need privacy in order to literally plan their escape from someone in their very own home. And then you can go all the way out to governments. We have a secret ballot in the United States so that people with less power can't be coerced into voting for somebody that people with more power in their lives, and historically that could be your employer, it could be somebody else in your household or someone else, can't coerce you into voting for who they want you to vote for, and on. Every movement for social change in our society, before it had a public conversation, had to have a private one so that people could organize without fear of the people currently in power crushing their work before they could be ready. So I think of privacy as deeply embedded in the idea of a democracy and the idea of self-governance. It also, of course, helps us increasingly in the commercial context where we have these giant companies who are using the fact that they surveil us everywhere we go to do things like set the prices we pay or decide what jobs we might get offered or decide, things about us that really our lack of privacy means that they have more power over us in ways that they are increasingly and visibly marshaling against us.
I like how you quoted Daniel Solove, a privacy expert and a past guest on the show, who said, it's far more helpful to explain what privacy is for than what privacy is. And I hear you saying that privacy is for defending people's rights and defending people who have less power than others.
Yes.
And that's very important. The cases that you cover in this book highlight the relationship between government surveillance and, as you just brought up, corporate surveillance.
Yeah.
And increasingly, those two forces work together. As you put it, the truth is that too much corporate power to spy on us and too much government power to spy on us are each a threat individually, and they combine for a truly toxic mix. Again, starting at the beginning, Cindy, if we go back to near the beginning of your memoir in the 1990s, this wasn't always the case, was it, that private companies were so freely sharing our data with government agencies?
Well, I mean, it depends on the companies. I mean, all of the cases that I talk about, certainly after the post-9/11 cases, are situations in which the government went to our service providers to get information about us. The mass telephone records collection that, Mr. Snowden revealed, like the government wasn't coming to each of us and asking us for our phone records. They went to the telecommunications companies. So it has absolutely always been the case in the digital age that the government goes not to us when they want to spy on us, especially en masse, but to the companies that serve us. But what's changed is that the rest of the internet's business model has increasingly been about surveillance. So the rise of the surveillance business model, you track Google, for instance, from, placing contextual ads based on what you were searching on to, the 360-degree surround surveillance that they are able to do. And it's not just them. Now there's all these shady data brokers and other people who we cannot see who are engaging in the kind of spying on us. That the rise of that business model has not gone unnoticed by the government. And now the number one purchaser of information from data brokers is the government. And, FBI Director Kash Patel just recently testified in front of Congress that, yes, they are doing that and they intend to keep doing it. So it's kind of something that the technology, as the business model grew, the ability of the government to do this has grown. And now we're in a place where they are really intertwined in a way that we're going to have to take some pretty big steps to fix. Now, they're not that hard, honestly, the steps, right? A pretty simple rule that says if somebody, whether they're the government or a private company, collects data from you for one purpose, like to make sure your phone rings wherever you are, they can't use it for another purpose. That's just it. And you can build out rules around that. There's lots of things you could do. But like that basic principle that you don't get to make secondary uses of data that you're collecting for a legit purpose would really shift the balance. And again, there's a number of ways, like from a policy geeky law perspective, you could get to that end. But that's one shift that we could make that would shift things pretty dramatically.
Okay, so we've covered two of the threads in the book, or two of the themes. One is this asymmetry of power that needs to be addressed, and people need their rights defended with privacy. The second theme is the combination of government and corporate surveillance and this toxic mix that creates. And then a third theme that comes up again and again in the book is the idea that, as you write, privacy and security are mutually reinforcing. I just wanted to spend a moment on this because there are people out there who feel like, hey, it's okay for the government to surveil us because the government's keeping us safe. And so we have to give up some of our privacy in order to have security. What do you say to that?
I mean, I think this, I think it's very easy to think that there's a teeter-totter, right? That if we, as long as we give up our privacy, we'll magically get more security. And that doesn't work on a technical level. And it also really doesn't work on a philosophical or you know, law word. And on the technical level, the technology that we freed up in the first case that I talk about in the first part of the book is called encryption technology. This is the Bernstein case. This technology is the ability, it's basically the science of secret codes, right? If you ever had a secret decoder ring, that was a very lightweight form of encryption. I scale this up to really sophisticated math, and you can really have a message that you encrypt on one end and somebody decrypts on the other, and people in between cannot have access to it. This is a way that you have privacy online. It's also the way you have security online. I think the thing that is important to remember is that you can't build a back door into people's lives or communications or homes that only a good guy can go through. If you open a back door on the idea that that'll help the good guys solve crimes, you're opening a back door for bad guys. And honestly, a house is not a bad way to think about it. That's how most computer scientists and security people will talk about back doors and encryption. And so for the government or society to say, you know, as long as you give up a little bit of your privacy, we can make you more secure. Underneath all of that is the idea that only the good guys would ever use this reduced privacy and reduced security. And that's just never been the case. On the other side of that, making us all less secure, I think there's probably situations in which it makes the police's job a little harder. But they have lots of other tools. Like, it's not like the only tool they have to keep us safe is the ability to read all of our emails and intercept our communications and know who all our associations are. That's not the only tool in their toolbox. So if we reduce that tool a little, we all get security, not, you know, against bad government, which of course is a thing, but also against the bad guys. So I just think that there's a lot of people, and some of this comes out of the post 9/11 rhetoric that I really have a hard time with, this idea that the answer to keeping us safe is giving up some of our own safety. Like, that it just doesn't work that way.
Let's talk a little bit about this first of three cases or series of cases that you cover in the book. As you say, it had to do with encryption. The book is also, as I said at the beginning, it's functioning as a memoir. So you're telling your own story as your career develops. So for this first case, you're just starting out, you're a young lawyer, you've done some human rights work, you get involved with the EFF, which had been founded just a few years before. And the issue in question for this series of cases was whether researchers could share computer code that encrypted data.
Yeah.
And this was pre-9/11, so 1990s. The U.S. government was already using national security as the excuse to crack down hard on these encryption algorithms. They actually, a detail that I found interesting is that the government said that these algorithms had to be regulated like a tank or a jet fighter that couldn't be exported to, you know, foreign powers without proper permission. How did you approach this first major legal challenge with a little bit of computer code being treated by the government like it was a tank?
Yeah, I mean, to the government's credit, I kind of understand why software with the capability of maintaining secrecy was like next to tanks and surface-to-air missiles on the, you know, list of things you can't export from the U.S. without a license. I mean, you know, historically, we know that the ability of the Allies to break the Germans' codes and the Japanese codes, the Enigma and the Purple Code, is part of why we feel like we won World War II. And I think there's a good story, you know, and encryption has been a military tool for a long, long time. There, Caesar had a cipher, you know, but it's also something that people not in military situations have needed, including, you know, the founders, right? Jefferson was in Paris. Adams was in London. The rest of the founding fathers were in the U.S. Jefferson actually had a cipher that, you know, it's a physical thing that you used in order for them to send messages and code to each other. So it's always something that people who aren't directly in wars needed, but I also understand why the military thought it was their thing. So, but what happened in the 90s is that the founders of the EFF realized that unless we freed up this technology from government control, we weren't going to have any security or privacy online. This is John Gilmore especially, but also John Perry Barlow and Mitch Kapor. And they identified this as one of the things we were going to need if we were going to have a secure internet. And the way that we approached it was really to think about what it was that my client, Dan Bernstein, was a math PhD student at UC Berkeley. What was he trying to do? He was trying to publish some encryption code online as part of a scientific conversation. You know, in addition to being a military thing, encryption is a science. It's a piece of applied math. And it's an active science. It still is today. It is something where people publish their ideas, other people take a look at them, they criticize them, and that conversation goes on, the kind of scientific method conversation that we all learned probably in grade school in the early 90s was already going on online. And so we took the position that Dan's interest in publishing his code was a publishing interest. This is a First Amendment interest, and that the computer program, the computer code he wanted to publish should be protected speech, just like other scientific speech. And then we applied the First Amendment tests to the government's licensing process and said, you know, it doesn't meet the tests for the First Amendment. So that was the strategy. And it really did grow out of what was actually happening online and how the science of cryptography worked. So, you know, we just presented that to the judge along with a lot of people who could affirm that we were right about this. And, you know, we were lucky enough to have a judge who was not very technical, but was willing to listen to us, and we succeeded.
Yeah, it was interesting in these various cases, you're talking about judge selection and what it was like going into the courtroom and how the EFF team was dressed versus the government. Lawyers are often dressed in these very expensive suits. So you get a real sense of your life as a lawyer beat by beat as you go through these odysseys.
Yeah, I thought it would be like there are plenty of people who can write academic or journalistic stories about privacy, but I got to live it. And so I really thought it would be an interesting way to get access to this is to have you kind of ride along on my shoulder as we did this. And we certainly were a ragtag team, especially in the 90s when we got started, who did not look like the normal people you see in a federal courthouse.
Those were early days for the EFF as well. Having been founded in 1990, as you said, the founders John Gilmore, Mitch Kapor, and John Perry Barlow, all technologists concerned about digital civil liberties, both around software and then online as the internet began to grow. My impression is that in the early days, before government and private actors really combined forces, like we talked about earlier, the EFF founders seemed to be mostly concerned with the intrusion of government into the digital world. And here, of course, I'm thinking of John Perry Barlow's 1996 Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, yep, where he's telling governments of the world to stay away from the online world. And I was glad to see your comment on that declaration in the book. You said, "I read it at the time and immediately disagreed with it," mm-hmm, which I was happy to see because it seems like today, his declaration hasn't aged particularly well because this idea that government should stay completely out of internet affairs seems to have helped create the conditions for those tech giants to build their surveillance empires unopposed.
Yeah, I think that I honestly think that Barlow would not be happy with how things have gone. Although, you know, one of the things that I think it's important to recognize the context in which he was saying it. You know, again, he and I disagreed. It's because he was aspirational, and I'm like a strategic lawyer in the courts, right? So he's like, we have a chance to build a better world here. But at the time in the 90s, the government wanted to get rid of, you know, the Communications Decency Act basically said you couldn't make indecent speech on the internet. That's the context in which he's saying government stay away. We don't want you coming in and deciding you know, I think it's very dangerous for a government to decide what speech is decent for the rest of us to hear, right? This all the way back to privacy, but also free speech interests in the Constitution. So Barlow was like, we got a chance to do something better here. You know, you weary giants of flesh and steel. I mean, this is not a policy prescription, right? And he was saying, let's give us a chance to build something better here. And if you read the rest of the declaration, that's exactly what he's saying. Let's do a place where people can speak without fear or favor. It's very aspirational. And what he told me later was, I was trying to will into being a better world by stating as if it was already true. And I think that that has to be right, because you don't simultaneously think the world is magically going to be better if there's no government and found the EFF and hire me, right? Like these two things don't go in the same direction. So, but I also think that this idea has been used by people who really just wanted all the power for themselves to build a world that I think is not there. Now, I don't know what Barlow would have thought. He's not around. He was definitely far more libertarian than me, far more skeptical of government intervention than I was. So maybe he would have thought that was okay. I don't know. I don't want to speak for him. But I know that he was pretty distressed near the end of his life at the rise of the tech giants and the way that they were making it hard for there to be new entrants into the digital world, that they were really locking up these sectors in ways that made innovation really hard. And I think that's a side effect of the failure of, honestly, antitrust and competition regulation more than online regulation, but whatever, however you want to do it. But yeah, you know, that's a situation in which I think that I understand where he was headed with it, but I think some ways it didn't reckon with what ultimately came later in terms of the rise of these five corporate entities that now control, you know, the vast majority of what we get to do online.
That's right. I think that's totally fair. And context is so important. And what you're saying rings true, because I was there.
Yeah.
And I remember that feeling that here we have an opportunity to build something different. And yeah, those ham-handed proposals to crack down on free speech online, that was just a non-starter for those of us who were there at the beginning.
Yep.
At the same time, I have to admit feeling some level of bitterness, I don't know any other word for it, that we have ended up where we are today, because I met some of those guys in the early days. And I felt like we all had this agreement. We're going to build something better and something different. And then, you know, eight of those guys, as you said, decided to go and become just like all the others before them that were just after money and power. In fact, I'd say they've done even worse things in some cases. And so yep. It's so disappointing that this somewhat utopian vision that Barlow and I and so many others had shared has turned into what's really, well, I don't want to get all depressing. We should be talking about your book.
Well, no, but I think it's a legit position, because I do think that, you know, what the old saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, like that people change when they get a lot of power, or maybe they were lying all along. But we're seeing a very different story out of the tech giants now that they've locked up their markets and, you know, meet the new boss, the same as the old boss. Right. And I think that one of the ways in which we have to think about how do we get out of this situation is how do we make it harder to become this kind of a boss? How do we, you know, some of the fights that we're having now about internet regulation, you know, are situations in which EFF is quite worried that we're just going to empower either a new set or the current set of leaders and make it harder for new people to come in and offer us new things. The internet kind of naturally, and the open source movement and lots of things actually make it possible to start new businesses with pretty low, or new services. It could be civic, it could be whatever, with pretty low barriers to entry, at least in the technical side. And my view is the way to get out of a world of dictators is to make it harder to be a dictator, not hope that make rules to make the dictators nicer. So the way I think about the way out of this is, how do we disempower these guys by empowering other people to come and offer us better services. And of course, that's my approach in part because I don't like the surveillance business model. I want other business models to take over. So I don't want them to be kinder, gentler surveillance people. I want them gone and small and unimportant. And so it's one of the ways in which when we're looking at the attempts to try to regulate now, some of them, which are very well-meaning, that's the lens that we're looking at them with, because we could, like some of the AI stuff we've seen could enshrine OpenAI as the only foundation model, or there are three of them, right? The big guys, right? And I think that you have to think not only about how mad you are at the current leaders, but how do we make sure that the rules we are creating for them don't entrench them further?
Well said. I also like that tagline, gone, small, and unimportant. That's what Facebook and Google and all the rest should become.
Well, and that used to happen, right? When, I mean, this is the other thing. You know, you're right that, you know, Barlow wasn't living in the time that we ended up living through in the same way. But it used to be there was a search engine, and then that search engine was cool for a while, and then somebody else came and made a better search engine. And then somebody, same with all these services, same with social, you know, the only social media in the world wasn't Facebook, right? They came along a little pretty late and later in times.
Right.
But then all the innovations stopped. And now we're still stuck with the same companies that kind of came of age in the, you know, middle 2000s. And
right.
Stopping that cycle has been very toxic for us. And they all, of course, have the same business model, which is the piece that really annoys me.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Cindy Cohen, author of the book Privacy's Defender, My 30-Year Fight Against Digital Surveillance. Cindy is the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, for a little while longer, anyway. And this book, you can tell, I enjoyed it. It's a great read. It's a memoir of her, as the subtitle says, her 3 decades fighting surveillance of us. The case studies in the book are mostly about government surveillance, but she's also, through the EFF, fought against big tech surveillance, a topic that I'll bring up later in the interview. If you'd like a link to the book and some links to other resources, find them on the episode page at the Tectonic website. Tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Click the link for the Cindy Cohen episode. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with Cindy Cohen here on Tectonic. Let's get back to the book and let's talk about the second case study. This one had to do with the NSA, the National Security Agency, and how it was found to be secretly spying on Americans in the years after 9/11. Before we get to the case itself, a key element of the arguments revolved around the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. Tectonic has listeners all over the world, so could you just give us a brief summary of what the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says and why it's relevant to a case involving government spying?
Yeah, so the Fourth Amendment says that you have the right to be secure in your papers and effects and your home. What that has been interpreted to mean is if the government wants to come in and invade your papers and your effects in your home, they have to go to a judge and get a probable cause warrant. That means that there's 3 branches of government. The 1 branch of government has to go to the other branch and get sign off before they can invade our privacy, our home. It doesn't say privacy, but it is a very, it's the effect is protecting our privacy. And the history of this Fourth Amendment is actually, I think, somewhat relevant. You know, I'm not much of an originalist, but the history of the Fourth Amendment came out of some problems that were happening under the colonial rule. And one of those things was these things called general warrants, where instead of getting a probable cause warrant about an individual, the government of the colonies would go to a judge and get a warrant about a crime. One of the crimes was tax evasion in the early colonial ages. You may remember there was a whole tea party about that. And with this general warrant, which only was about the crime and not about who to search, the British would search anybody's home based upon the fact that there might have been a crime there. So it was the fight over these general warrants. They're also called writs of assistance. That was one of the key reasons that the Americans decided they had to throw off British rule. And there's a very famous scene in a courtroom with a guy named John Otis, who was a lawyer that John Adams was watching, and he was fighting the general warrants and he lost. And John Adams said, then and there, the child independence was born. So this is not like subtle analysis. Like, this is John Adams saying, because of general warrants, we fought the revolution. And I think he's a pretty good source for this. So the Fourth Amendment comes out of this idea that the government has to specifically identify you and get specific permission to search through your papers. So fast forward to the mass spying after September 11th, what the NSA decided that it was going to do was collect everybody's records, communications records, and tapping into the internet backbone so they could get copies of all the traffic of our communications first, collect it all first, and sort out what they actually needed second. And our argument is that's not that different from what the British were doing. This is mass collection first, mass searching first, without individually identifying the targets or doing the work to go to a court and get approval for the specific investigation that they're doing. So that's why I think the Fourth Amendment is in serious tension with the mass spying. That's kind of the fundamental crux of why I think mass spying is inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment.
Your argument there is so clear and so solid and so right. I mean, of course, that's what the government was engaged in warrantless mass surveillance, which is illegal under the Constitution. And yet you tell the story in the book about how you're arguing this, and the government is just resisting fiercely. And much of their defense rests on the state secrets privilege.
Yes.
What was that?
So the state secrets privilege is something that the judges created. Congress never created a state secrets privilege, but this was an idea that was developed in the 70s or 80s. There's an earlier case called Reynolds that started, it might even be a little earlier than that, but that if the courts are looking at something where national security can be at risk, the government can come in and assert a privilege to remove specific evidence from the case that might hurt national security. Generally, this is in the context of somebody like, say, a spy who's suing, or in the original case was a secret spy flight of a plane that crashed, and the family members of the people who died in the crash wanted to know whether the government was negligent or not. And the government said, oh, this was a secret spy flight. If we tell you this, you know, national security will be violated. And the court issued this kind of what I think of as a pretty narrow exception. But now we see, especially after post 9/11, it being used over and over again to kind of whole swaths of things, huge programs that are costing the American taxpayers millions, if not billions of dollars, being excluded from judicial review. And here, being excluded from even the question about whether the constitutional rights of millions of Americans were being violated on a claim of secrecy. And sadly, that worked. That worked ultimately in the U.S. Supreme Court. And I just think it's really wrong and dangerous. But that is the fight that we had over and over again for, gosh, close to 17 years. We would win a little and then we'd lose a little. There was a lot of drama along the way, including, you know, Mr. Snowden showing up with a bunch of records and things like that. So it wasn't originally a dead letter case, but ultimately over time, the courts really got more and more afraid to tell the government no.
So where are we today? I mean, is the NSA still collecting all of our data? They have that Utah data center that you mentioned in the book.
So there were three mass programs that we sued over and we discovered, and all of them have been scaled back dramatically, although there's still too much. We still have a lot more to do. And in fact, in April, one of the key legal authorities authorizing some of this stuff is up for renewal. And there's a big congressional fight that's going to happen. It's already starting to happen around it. But of the three programs, one was the mass collection of telephone records. People who were around for the Snowden revelations may recall that the very first thing that they released was confirmation that that program existed. Remember, when we started this litigation in 2006, the government was basically just denying that this was happening. So in the mass telephone records collection, the mass internet metadata collection, and, you know, metadata, think about in the context of, say, a letter, the metadata is the address information on the front and the, you know, the stamp that says where it was mailed from, and the content is the stuff inside. So the mass internet metadata collection, which can include your location, who you talk to, how often you talk to them, and then the tapping into the internet backbone evidence that we had specifically about an AT&T facility in downtown San Francisco that we had the schematics for, thanks to a whistleblower named Mark Klein. So of these three programs, the mass metadata collection is dead. And some of that was the pressure we gave. Some of it was pressure in Congress, and Senator Wyden is really a hero for that one. The mass telephone records collection is over, but they replaced it with a collection strategy that's still too broad, but it's not the mass collection in the same way. And then the tapping into the internet backbone has also been scaled back. They can't look at the content of the communications anymore. They can only look at the metadata. So all of them, we've scaled back a lot. We've got congressional oversight now. It's not happening with the same level of secrecy that it was before, although there's still too much. And the secret FISA court is involved, at least at a very high level. So we've got some steps towards oversight. We've got some of them scaled back and some of it eliminated. But the core concerns about mass spying on Americans still exist today.
You worked on this case, the second series of cases, well over a decade, and going through the twists and turns of the hearings and the responses from judges and the defense from the government, you get a sense of just how much persistence you need in order to see it all the way through. And so I admire your perseverance, the EFF's perseverance, and appreciate that you were able to deliver what you did relatively on a shoestring budget compared to the government's defense. And at the same time, as you're pointing out, there's more to do. I mean, I'm sensitive to surveillance. I cover it a lot on this show. And so I'm aware of it. I live in New York City and I walk down the street and everywhere I go, I can see government spy cameras here, here, and here, and big tech company spy cameras over here, and who knows how many other sensors and microphones and devices. Now, sometimes people are wearing Mark Zuckerberg spy glasses on their face, spying on me and others on the street. Where are we today, Cindy, in 2026, if we're all subject to constant surveillance, which is something you write in the book is a huge encroachment of rights?
I think I look at it two ways. I think that it's definitely the case that the technology and the embrace of the surveillance business model and the government's embrace of this is, it's just bigger now. The tech allows it. I think AI supercharges it in ways that, you know, the government used to be pretty good at collecting information and pretty limited in what it could do with it or would do with it. You know, when we started, this was just the NSA that had this ability, and they're pretty protective of what they do and who gets to know about it because they're trying to protect their sources and methods. Now we've got cops on the street. We've got ICE agents sticking facial recognition stuff in people's faces. So it's a whole wider range of government and non-governmental sources that are able to gather information about it and marshal it against us. So in some ways, it's a lot worse, and some of that's due to technology, and some of that's due to the fact that we've been unwilling to step forward and actually take a stand to regain our privacy. And we need to do that. I think that's true. I would say on the other side, we have solved bigger problems as a country. Like, we ended slavery. We enfranchised huge percentages of our populations. This is that level of a fight. And we shouldn't kid ourselves that this is like a TV movie where we're going to defeat the national security infrastructure of the United States within a 45-minute thing and then, you know, get move on to the next. Like, this, that's not how national security fights work. And you just have to know that this is, we chip away and we chip away. And, you know, we won a very big step in the encryption fights kind of easily in the 90s. But after 9/11, fighting the national security infrastructure of the United States is it's a long-term process. And you have to think about it the way we think about fighting global warming, the way we think about fighting for justice for other people, where, you know, it's something that we kind of always have to do. And then sometimes we're winning more and sometimes we're winning less. But the national security folks don't ever just like go away. There's too much money. There's too much infrastructure. There's too much behind it that, you know, and you're right. You know, we've always had a shoestring budget. You know, big thanks to all the EFF members who have supported us year in and year out. We get better at this. We were able to chip away at it because we had people who were willing to support us, you know, even the years when things were not looking good, and let us continue to hold this fight up to the Justice Department, where, you know, those guys stay in their jobs for their whole career and get better at it. And we've been able to do the same on our side at a much smaller scale because of our loyal supporters. But these are not little fights. And, you know, my friend Cory Doctorow, who's been on your show, says, you know, you may not be able to see the end of the road, but we always keep fighting for higher ground and continue to push towards higher ground. There are plenty of easy fights, and I love easy fights, but if we really want to regain control of our privacy and security, we have to look at this as something that we do for the long run.
I appreciate you framing it that way, because it's important for people to know what they're getting into if they want to join this resistance. This is going to be a long, long process. And sometimes, I'm speaking for myself, sometimes it can feel like a slog. I mean, I've been at this show for over 8 years, and in over 400 episodes of warning people about all the harms that are coming, it seems like the adversaries have only gotten stronger over that time period. And so sometimes it can be a little dispiriting, but I appreciated this tip. Actually, you shared a number of bits of wisdom from mentors and colleagues along the way in this memoir. One of them was from your co-counsel on the first set of cases, Bob Korn Revere. You write, after one of our early interim victories, he said, "Be sure to let yourself enjoy this feeling now. We don't win a lot in this kind of work, so we need to celebrate every single little victory. If we wait for the end of the case in order to let ourselves be happy, we may miss our chance." And that rang so true to me, because once in a while, there's some good news. The good guys get one little victory, and I try to celebrate it on this show while still contextualizing it that we still have a long road in front of us.
Yeah, you know, that Bob is now at FIRE, and we're still good friends. And I think that it was some of the wisest advice. And, you know, we joke at EFF that we declare victory early and often, right? But that's a strategy to recognize that, you know, especially if you're committed to justice, you have these goggles where you see all the injustices in the world, and it can feel overwhelming. But being part of the good guys is fun. And it's much more fun when we win. Don't get me wrong. I like to win. It's very important. But having the camaraderie, building the community, having the space where, you know, it may be a rotten day for you, but it's an okay day for someone else, and they can pick up and push away. I used to joke at EFF that we had the outrage stick, and we'd pass the outrage stick around. And so that, you know, not everybody is outraged at the exact same time and at the exact same level. So if you share the weight, you can do this for the long run. And it's still fun to wake up and feel like you're part of the good guys every day. I joke that the good guys throw better parties than the bad guys. I don't mean to say that it doesn't matter whether you win or not, because it's all about the friends you made along the way. Like, that is not my view, but you do make community and friends along the way. And that's important, and it's important to enjoy and take life from that because what we're doing is hard.
Well, Cindy, all three case studies in this book have to do with government surveillance and to some extent the surveillance from telecom companies like Verizon and others. But I don't want listeners to get the impression that EFF only focuses on that. There are plenty of projects and initiatives that EFF has launched that have to do with corporate surveillance as well, protecting people from that. Can you just give us an overview of what listeners might want to draw on EFF for to protect their privacy?
Yeah, so EFF has got kind of a three-pillar structure. There's the lawyers, which I'm one of. There's the technologists, and there's the activist. And when it works well, we're all supporting each other. And EFF actually develops technologies that help keep people private and secure. There's a plugin for Firefox and Chrome called Privacy Badger that helps block third-party cookies. We support CertBot, which is a certificate authority, certificate service that helps make sure that when you think you're going to your bank, you're actually going to your bank. And these are all open source projects where people who are technical can come and help. And then our activists do a lot of work trying to help, you know, marshal the legislature and local, you know, local activists and support them in trying to make change. You know, EFF has long argued for a comprehensive privacy law to protect all of us from the surveillance business model. We've done a lot of policy work around that in addition to Privacy Badger, which actually just blocks the cookies. We've worked a lot to try to pass comprehensive privacy law that will help protect people and draw attention to the risks and dangers of this surveillance business model. So we work on a wide range of issues, local all the way up to national, and we have an international team as well that's very active, especially in the EU, because a lot of privacy and internet regulatory work is actually happening on the EU side as well. So we try to go wherever the fights are. And as the internet has grown, so has the organization.
We should say a word about your upcoming transition. As I said earlier, you're going to be stepping down as executive director of the EFF. I'm sure you've been asked this a bunch of times, but I have to ask, what's next for you, Cindy?
Well, first of all, EFF is in really good hands. My long friend and colleague, Nicole Osier, is going to take over as the executive director in June. She's great in many ways. I'm kind of a litigator who got pushed into being a leader, whereas she's an actual leader and has been for a long time. She used to work at the ACLU, and we're friends. So I'm very excited for EFF's next chapter, and I know the organization is in very good hands. For me, I miss the fight. I want to get back into a little closer to the fight. So I haven't decided yet. I'm trying to be open and see what comes along. But, you know, the stories I tell in the book are about the times when I got to stand up more directly for freedom and justice. And I miss being in that seat as opposed to the executive director role where you end up having, you know, EFF's 120 people. You need to help run the organization. That's a really important role, but it's not the one where you get to write the briefs and organize the cases. So I'm looking for opportunities to get closer into the fight. I'm still very passionate about pushing back on the national security holes that we've blown into the Constitution and our rights. I'm interested in a lot of other justice issues. So sometime, hopefully in the fall, you know, after Nikki's firmly in charge, I will decide what, you know, I'll kind of do my next thing. But I'm not done. I just felt like the organization, after I've been there 26 years, that for a healthy organization, it's important to pass the torch and let other people lead. And both for me personally and for the organization, it felt like the right time.
The book is called Privacy's Defender, My 30-Year Fight Against Digital Surveillance by you, Cindy Cohen. Thank you so much for talking with me and wish you the best of luck in whatever you do next.
Thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time to read it and to have such a great conversation about it.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remainder of the show. We just heard my interview with Cindy Cohen, author of the memoir, Privacy's Defender, My 30-Year Fight Against Digital Surveillance, as published by MIT Press. And as you heard in the interview, Cindy is stepping down as executive director of the EFF, has done great work in that role, and EFF, as she assures us, is going to continue to do its important work in digital rights, defending those, as she put it at the beginning of the interview, defending those who have less power than the government agencies and the tech giants that are spying on them. And that's all of us. I mean, who has the power to take on a Facebook, a Google, an NSA, who knows who is spying on all of us? Those agencies and companies have the asymmetry of power, have the advantage of asymmetrical power over all of us. And so it's good that there are people like Cindy and there are organizations like the EFF out there that are working on our behalf. As I said earlier, if you'd like links to the EFF and Cindy and the book and some other things, you can find them all on the episode page, which is at the Tectonic website. That's tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Just click the link for the Cindy Cohen Show. And I appreciated in reading this book, as I told her, all of the little details in the wisdom and the advice and the hard-won knowledge that she's getting and passing along to the readers along the way from these long cases, and that she's hearing from colleagues and mentors. And just that idea that we should celebrate every little victory along the way really resonated with me. Because as I said, this show has been going on for a while, and the fight against digital surveillance has been going on much longer. And a key point, friends, we should just say it out loud, is that this fight is going to take a long time from here. I mean, it's been going on for years, but it could last a generation. It could last multiple generations. So those of us who consider ourselves in the resistance, as I do, and I would invite you to as well, maybe you already do, all of us in the resistance to digital surveillance have a long, long fight ahead of us. And so we cannot wait for the very end when the credits roll and show that we finally won the fight, which we will eventually, but we can't wait for that, because who knows, you know, really how long it's going to be and how many generations are going to pass. So in the meantime, whenever we have a small success, a small victory, we win along the way, even if it's a tiny little step forward, we should celebrate. And that's what I've tried to do recently. I don't know if you've noticed this, but in recent episodes, I've been trying to highlight some good news coming out of our tech dystopia. The court cases against Facebook and Google, for instance, in New Mexico and California, those were small but very important victories that we won against Facebook in both cases, and Google was a co-defendant in one of those cases. So I'm happy to celebrate the good news, and I will continue to do that. And I appreciate Cindy writing the book, sharing her wisdom, and allowing us to pass it along. And I hope you have found this enlightening and maybe a little bit hopeful. And that's about all the time I have today. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, you know exactly what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And to go out today, you know, I was thinking about John Perry Barlow, which, by the way, I meant to say that his Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, it's linked from the episode page, so you can go read it. It's short, but it's interesting. John Perry Barlow, in addition to writing that declaration and co-founding the EFF, he also was a lyricist for the Grateful Dead. And I believe the very first song that he served as lyricist on was Mexicali Blues. And so in honor of the late, great John Perry Barlow, I thought we could go out to that song. Hope you enjoy it, and really, have a great week, everybody. I'll see you next time.
Opening our show, as usual, with the microdose of Yes, 5% for Nothing. I never give the information about that track. Figure most of you will know it by now, or you knew it already. 5% for Nothing, a Bill Bruford composition from the album Fragile. And I only actually learned the story behind that title kind of recently. It's kind of funny. It was a jab at their manager, the manager of the band Yes, who, in Bill Bruford's opinion, was being paid 5% for nothing. That's good. That's funny. Good one, Bill. My name is Dave Mandel. This show is called It's Complicated. I'm here every Monday evening at 7 p.m., bringing you an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music for your pleasure. We're going to start tonight's show with a Swedish group called Mosaic. That's Mosaic with a K. You're going to hear a track from a self-titled album originally released in 1982, I'm going to say, and reissued just recently, just late last year, I think, on the Musea label, M-U-S-E-A, which I mentioned from time to time. Musea is a French label. Well, it used to be a real physical, in-the-flesh label. Now it's also, they also have a presence on Bandcamp, a large presence on Bandcamp, and it's a really good label. They do a lot of reissues of great French prog records, but also a lot of newer stuff as well. So you should check them out. I say Musea, M-U-S-E-A. So this is something that they reissued. Again, a group called Mosaic with a K, 1982. I'd say kind of some kind of cross between Yes and fusion. This is Mosaic.